Hello, bookcasers, book nerds. Hello, and welcome to the 102nd episode of The Bookcase. I am one of your hosts, Kate Gibson.
And I'm Charlie Gibson, the other host, Kate's father. And I'm sure that all of you are keeping exact count on how many of these bookcase episodes we've done. We have, and we hope you have been with us for all 102. But if you haven't, you're forgiven. We have a very interesting book today. And what attracted me to it, and I called Kate and said, I want you to read this, was a publisher's blurb that came to us in a sheet of paper inserted in the book that said, this is a book about in which the author was going to write a memoir of her mother who lived an unexceptional life. And could you write a book about somebody who read an unexceptional life? Except I thought that was a fascinating sort of premise. And then I found in reading it that her mother had read a really exceptional life. The author's name is Kao Kalia Yang, K-A-O-K-A-L-I-A-Y-A-N-G. Three words, Kao Kalia Yang. The name of the book is Where Rivers Part. Her mother was a refugee who came to this country, immigrated from Thailand, but she grew up in Laos just in the wake of the Vietnam War, where the North Vietnamese were hunting down people of her tribe, trying to kill them because the Hmongs, and she is a Hmong, H-M-O-N-G, had assisted the Americans during the Vietnam War. So she had to live for years in a forest to escape the North Vietnamese and the Pathet Lao. Then she lived in a refugee camp in Thailand for a number of years. And then she came to the United States. I thought that was a really interesting journey, Kate.
You know, I feel like in some ways I have lived such a privileged life that when somebody says to me, oh, you know, it's an ordinary story, I think to myself, well, they got up then, they made themselves breakfast, and then they commuted every day. I think to me, one of the things that hit me and that reminded me of my privilege is she considers this story to be ordinary. And perhaps it is a story that would be common among refugees fleeing their home country to immigrate to this country. But it's an extraordinary story. Yeah. And I think it reminds us that refugees who really make the journey to come to this country, everyone has a story and everyone is extraordinary. And one of the things I admire Kao Kalia Yang most for in this book is that she has the courage to write her mother's memoir from the first person perspective. She writes it from I. And boy, I would find it so, I mean, neither you nor mom were refugees, but I would find it very intimidating to write from your perspective, to write trauma from your perspective, to write your biography from your eyes. And I think she really pulls it off. It's really beautiful.
Well, there were times when I thought, this is actually her mother writing to me, but I had to keep reminding myself, this is Kao Kalia Yang writing in the first person, in her mother's first person. I thought that was an interesting choice as a way to tell her mother's story. I couldn't believe she knew that much about what her mother was thinking. And we do talk about it in our conversation. Her mom is still alive. And I can't believe that she wouldn't feel enormously touched by this book. I was touched by this book. I think it is a wonderful salute to motherhood. I hope if you're listening to this podcast, you will stick around for the coda. Because in this book, there is a paragraph that she wrote. Both Kate and I called each other and said, have you read that? It's a beautiful paragraph about being a mother and how important mothers are. She had two daughters when she escaped from Laos into Thailand. She married a man that she met in the refugee camp who told her, I have nothing to offer you. She left her mother when she left Laos and went to Thailand. In the refugee camp, she had six miscarriages. And then when she came to the United States, she got pregnant. She had a whole bunch of more kids. And her kids have all done so well. Her daughter wrote this book. She had kids who went to some of the American finest colleges. It's a wonderful, wonderful story.
She came to the U.S. and she got her degree. I mean, she just, this woman had reservoirs upon reservoirs of strength. In some ways, I feel like this is the novelization of the stories you hear about mothers lifting the cars off of their children. I think, you know, when you watch tragic stories of other children, whether they're refugees fleeing from other countries, children who are fighting diseases or are born from mothers of addiction, you think to yourself, I could never survive that. I could never do that. I would never be able to survive that. But you do for your kids.
Yeah.
You do for your kids. You lift up that car.
Yeah.
You spend those weeks on the hospital couch. You do for your kids. And this book is, I think, a beautiful novelization of that.
Yeah. Yeah. she says, could I make a story out of a perfectly commonplace life? It is not at all commonplace. And her mother, well, her mom didn't speak much English, still doesn't. And so her mother couldn't really advance. She worked in a factory. She did all sorts of menial jobs, didn't get promotions, was always seen as a wonderful worker, but didn't get promotions because, well, because she was new to this country and didn't speak much English. Anyway, we recommend it strongly. It's a very moving story about her mom. Where Rivers Bark, Cal Kalia Yang. Here's our conversation.
Cal Kalia Yang, it is such an honor to have you in the bookcase. We are really excited about this book, Where Rivers Part, a terrific memoir about your mom. I want to start with, did you know when you sat down you were going to write it from the eye? Did you know when you started you were going to do that, that that was the way you wanted to tell the story, and why?
I wish I did. I had no idea, Kate. When I started, I tried everything but. And then eventually, the eye was the only pathway into the story. I wanted the readers to get as close as they could to Jumwa, to my mother.
As I read it, I kept thinking she is writing this in the first person, though it's a memoir about the person who's talking to me. And I kept thinking, how does she know so many details about what her mother was thinking that she could write it in her mother's first person voice?
If I were a younger writer, I don't think I could have, Charlie. You know, this is the third memoir, and what I see is a trilogy, The Late Homecomer, The Song Poet, and then Where Rivers Part. And, you know, in all that time, I've been growing as a writer in terms of my hold on craft and perspective. The thing about the first person perspective is that you have to travel with the emotions and the perspective of one person throughout. The perspective was not difficult for me, but the emotions were. Mm. And so as I was writing it, I would find myself just devastated and crying. But the fingers kept on going. But I understood that as a writer, part of the reason why I'd gone on this journey was so I could bring something back for my mother so that she could have something of herself again, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you talk about this book being sort of the last of the trilogy. Did you save this one for last on purpose? Because I read you say that your mom is not a talker. So I would imagine getting all of that information, emotion, trauma from her would have been hard. Is that why you left it for last?
That is part of the reason. The other part of the reason is I had to understand what love, you know, the force of love in a different way. I became a writer at the age of 27. I wasn't yet in love. I had not committed myself to anyone else. And certainly I was not a mother. And so I knew, a part of me knew that I wasn't ready. I couldn't do justice to my mother's story until certain things were established in my own life. And that, I think, was a wise decision. This is the most intimate of the three memoirs. And I think it builds on all of the skill sets I've learned in the process of my journey thus far. My mother is still alive. And that is also one of the reasons why I wrote it when I did. You know, when my mother's brother, when his wife died, my mother called him and he said, Ju, if you have anything to say to me at all, I want you to say it now so that I can answer you. And my mother couldn't say anything, but her brother said, well, if you can't say anything, then I want you to know that you were the blanket that kept my heart warm when our father died. And those words have stayed with me. I want to write this book when my mother can still respond to me, Charlie and Kate. I want her to know that this is the ways in which her story has not only impacted me, but is somehow alive within me.
But I wanted to go back for a second because you said it was important that you needed to have a certain perspective when you went to write this story. Could somebody who wasn't a mother have written your mother's story?
I don't think, definitely not in the ways that I did, you know, Kate. And for example, the part about the miscarriages, I had seen my mother go through them. I had seen the darkness of that period in real time. But until I had my own miscarriage, I didn't know the total isolation. I didn't know the pain, the singular pain. You know, you don't have a baby in your arms, but your breasts are heavy with milk. All of these details, you know, I never knew. I would never have known how to ask my mother.
Mm. Well, you're referring there, obviously, to the amazing number of miscarriages that she had while in the refugee camp. Six miscarriages. and you go through the process of being a mother, but you don't have a baby in your arms. And that's very poignant the way you write about it. But a lot of it that's written in the first person is when you were very young and your mother was in the refugee camp in Thailand. Did you have to interview her to find out what her emotions were and her thoughts were at that time?
I don't interview, which is interesting. As a creative nonfiction writer, I don't interview Charlie. I have conversations and I listen very deeply. I ask open-ended questions and then I travel wherever they lead me. I don't try to make people feel better because they feel sad because of the sadness in the stories, the sorrow in their life. I weep with them sometimes, of course. One of the things that was so important to me was permission. I asked my mom, I said, "Mom, can I write your story?" She looked at me and she said, nobody would be interested. Similarly to my dad, nobody is interested. Just because we've survived a war, just because we're poor, this makes us like most of the world. It does not make us incredible.
Yes, you write in the prologue, "My mom is afraid that no one will be interested in a story about her life. My mom is afraid that I've wasted my time in writing the story of her life." Does she still feel that way with the completed manuscript?
Whenever I read to her from the book and I translate it, my mother weeps. And then she'll tell me a different story that can never go into the book. The thing is written. But both of you are laughing because this is the truth, I think, of these relationships. You know, sure. We're all vessels of stories. And as parents, you hold them and you want to share them at different places and spaces, you know, in the hopes of other things. So for my mother, she's very nervous right now. Every review that comes out, I read it to her. But this is interesting, and I did not expect this. My dad is a song poet in the Hmong tradition. He tells me all the time, human life is individual. It is not unique. He says that it is the work of the artist to harvest from the garden of humanity. My mother does not say these things to me. But I think in writing this book, it's much more moving for her. The whole process of the book and the book being in the world, having this document of her life. So when, you know, she's like, "What did the New York Times say?" And I said, "It's not a review of the book. They published an interview." And she says, "Did the person read the book?" And I said, "Yes." She's like, "Did she like it?" And I said, "I think she liked it very much, Mom." And she goes, "Okay, then." You know, my mom and dad, their final word on everything is "okay then." And so that's it, the space where we are. Okay then. Then what? And I think that what neither of us know how to anticipate. So we're suspended in the air.
I had never thought about how intimidating it would be, because in some ways every review is a validation. It shouldn't be, but every review is a validation or not of your story. Was this intimidating? And who is the most intimidating to share with in your family?
It doesn't get easier. I've done this twice before. It doesn't get easier. You know, as the younger siblings get older, their opinions mature, Kate, and they become stronger, not less so. That's what I'm discovering. It was incredibly intimidating because she is our mother. We all love her. We want to protect her in many ways. On the title, I was very deliberate. You know, this is a story of my mother's life. I left room for each of them, if they wanted, to go in and write their own story. So consciously, from a writing perspective, right from the onset, there's that space that I've left behind or left wide open for them. I was most scared of Shell, actually. She's one of my younger sisters. She has strong opinions, but more than that, she's so much like our mother. Mm. But Kate, I've given them, you know, full access to the advanced copies. I don't think any of them have read it yet. They're not ready. Mm. They go to my talks and they're just puddles of tears. They're crying. They're so moved.
What did your mom think about your decision to write her story in the first person? Did she say, "Kalia, you can't speak for me"? Or did she understand why?
My mom and my dad, Charlie, and, you know, because it's your daughter you're doing this podcast with, I think they want me to do well. They want me to grow in ways that they can't anticipate. And in doing so, they know that I have to make moves that I feel are important on the page. Mm. My parents, neither of them read or write in English very well. And so they trust that I'm doing the best work that I know how to do. They're scared for me in terms of how the world will react. But my mom, from the very beginning, she says, this is your book. This is your book. Because I'll say, Mom, the story about your life, your book. She goes, no, this is your book. And so that license of love, which is to say, I understand the gravity that is on my shoulders. And I understand the responsibility that I hold to her story, to honoring the women before her, but also the woman that I am, because I am hers. And then I think my parents have always said, I'm like a dog after the scent of a bone. I don't know when to stop, you know? And so I don't stop. And when I was on this journey, I think it was just really important that I get to the end that I needed.
You write about the birth of each one of her children. And in some ways, towards the end, every child gets their own chapter, gets their own love letter. And your older sister gets her own love letter. You just sort of appear. There's a chapter that says, I have two daughters. And I went, whoa, hello, she has a second daughter. So I'm interested in sort of why you didn't give yourself that love letter that your mom gave to the other kids from the first person perspective. But also, is it difficult to write? I was thinking about the challenge a writer would face writing about themselves through the eyes of somebody that they love. You have to bring all those biases and perspectives to that. So what was that like? And why don't you get your own love letter?
You know, I wanted to do something distinctly for my mom and for my siblings with this book. And from a craft perspective, when I was thinking about those parts of her years, her mothering years, I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I could pull this off? You know, but I asked my mother, what do you want to say to each of them? And so she told me in different ways. And those things became the basis of those chapters that's in the book. But as the author, Kate, the fact that she's already giving me the story, isn't that the greatest love letter of all? So I didn't want to overstep. You know, I understood the enormity of like the gift that she's given me and how much that shows already to the readers out there. And so I just wanted to hold that tenderness close in the form of the whole book. The whole book is in many ways her love letter to me as much as it is my love letter to her. And as children, how often in a life do we get to do that to our parents when they're still here? Do that with them, to do that kind of exchange. Like, everything you are has made me, and now everything that I have as a writer, I'm putting at the service of this life that you have lived.
Oh, I love that answer. Thank you.
I'm curious about your mom's attitude toward the United States. She is 8 years in the refugee camp in Thailand. And then she comes to the U.S. speaking no English, going to high school in her 30s, again, speaking no English. And she writes, you write about her opinion, that she always feels that racism is right there, that America is a racist country, but, and is racist toward the Hmong who are here. And yet she writes, or you write for her, somewhat admiringly about the story, which is extraordinary, that all of her children have done so well here in this country. What is her feeling about the country now?
My mother has been here longer than she has been in both Laos and Thailand combined, Charlie. I think that is a really important part of the equation. I think that she knows America in ways that she never got to know Thailand. In Thailand, she was in a refugee camp. She couldn't leave. She was pretty much a captive in a big cage. In Laos, she was a child surrounded by the tall mountains, you know, trails leading away. She could only walk them, accompanied by the people who loved her. In America, my mother has gone to places where none of us could have gone with her. In America, she's journeyed and seen horizons that she certainly never knew existed as a girl. My mother is a very practical woman. I remember being much younger, and my mother would apply for these promotions that she never got. And she kept them, these rejections, where everybody would say, you're such a good worker, but it's not a good fit. She would keep them. And I remember once asking her, why don't you just throw them away? They hurt you so. And she said, so that you can learn the truth. You're a woman. You're going to be working in America. There will be jobs that you want that you will never have. She looks at me and she says to me, remember this, you will be equally defined by the opportunities that you were denied. not just by those that you were given. Mm. You're going to be a woman one day in America. You must know this. Mm. That's my mother.
It was also a difficult marriage. She meets this man while she and her family are trying to escape from the North Vietnamese and the Pathet Lao, who want to kill them because the Hmong cooperated with the United States during the Vietnam War. And she meets this man very close to her own family. She meets this man who says, I can give you nothing. I have no money. I have no standing. I can only give you myself. And she leaves with him all the time questioning, did I do the right thing? All for the rest of her life questioning, did I do the right thing? And are we really a good couple? And yet they always came back to each other. When there was opportunities to separate, they came back to each other. As you wrote about it, I would think it's very difficult to write about your parents' marriage. So how did you approach it? And how did you feel you needed to depict the tough times between them?
You know, the depiction of marriage in Where Rivers Part taught me a lot of things, Charlie and Kate, that I never knew before. When you think of marriage, I know people have bad days. I didn't know that people had bad weeks or bad months or bad years. I didn't know that they had bad decades. I didn't understand, as I was journeying through their story, I didn't understand that marriage was a continuous decision and that any given action can take away every decision you've ever made. That the joys and the sorrows, they just grow and they get layered and they get complicated. The depiction of marriage in there is far from anything I thought I would ever write about the institution itself. And yet, you know, I'm in my own marriage. I'm now in my 12th year and I can see echoes of it all over the place. I understand as I was writing it and I was reading parts of it to my mom that she was learning new things about her own marriage. Children look at parents. They look closely at these individuals, these people that have come together, strangers, to make them possible. My mom had no idea that I'd been looking so closely all of those years. I think that was a shocker for her, you know. But you're right. There was nothing easy about it. My mom always says, if life had been different, I wouldn't have been with your father. If I were not with your father, my life could have been so much better. My father has never said these things. And when I was young, I thought, my mom is hurting my dad's feelings. But then I grew up and I got older and I'm in my own marriage. And I'm like, oh, my mom is reminding my dad of how lucky he is to be with her and how lucky he has been to have found such a steadfast person. Women like her were not born with luck on their side. She has had to persist. All the women before her have persisted. The only thing she hopes is that somehow with her life that her daughters will have better luck. And yet she will remind me, Charlie, love cannot protect. Love never could. It couldn't protect the bullets. It couldn't protect against the poverty. It can't protect. Love must remember. Love must be patient. Love must be kind. And these things, this incredible force lives everywhere, across all of the rivers.
Are you a poet like your dad?
No, I'm the daughter of a song poet. My father, he makes the images on the walls. He turns them into paintings we've never seen, Kate. It's such a gift. I'm a song poet's daughter. The empty space between the words, the empty space on a page doesn't yet speak to me in the profound ways that it speaks to my poet friends or to my father.
So the poem at the beginning of the book, did you write it?
Yes, I did.
So is Kalia a song poet? Well, we asked her to read the poem that she wrote that appears early in the book.
There was once a Hmong house that sat where two rivers met. The house was made of wood. There was a shingle bamboo roof on top. Out back, there was a garden filled with herbs and spices. In my memories, the house fills my heart. Remembering it makes me weep. One day, I will return. The small house will be full of people again. Mother will sit among the flowering mint in the garden. Father will stand by the door underneath the overhang of the roof. My brothers and sisters will bond. The living and the dead will be together at long last. There was once a Hmong house that sat where two rivers met.
Mm. Really nice.
Why are And you don't call yourself so at what point does a person writing a poem become a song poet? I'll ask you that.
Oh, if they can sing it into being, if they can breathe life into it. I'm a song poet's daughter. I was trained, you know, at the feet of one of the great poets of my life. When I was a child, we would go on vacations and we couldn't afford vacations, but we get all in the car. Dad would drive us across the river to Wisconsin and we stop at a rest stop and then come home. But on these trips, he would say, "What does the fast speeding train have to say to the long flowing river?" And my siblings and I, we would take part in that conversation, you know? And so in many ways, my sensibilities are a poet's sensibility of the world. I think anyone who speaks to me say that they hear the echoes of poetry in my words. But Kate, when I speak too fast. The spaces in between my words, they're not holding hands. It's a lot of cutting in between. And I think poets, they can control what happens between words in ways that I cannot. I live on the basis of the sentence that poets die on the word.
Well, you may not be a song poet, but you write lyrically and you talk lyrically, speak lyrically. It has been a pleasure to talk to you. Kalia, we'll ask you to stand by. We have some rapid fire questions for you, but thank you.
So I have to tell you guys a story. A few years ago for Christmas, my mom gave me a book of her Storyworth writings. What does that mean? Storyworth published a small 146-page hardbound book of her written memories, each answering one of Storyworth's thoughtful weekly writing prompts. And the questions are compelling, like, what were you like at 30? What was your favorite toy growing up? Do you remember your first trip on an airplane? She loved walking down memory lane with Storyworth, and I loved reading all about her life. I learned so much about her through this amazing book, and it's now one of my most prized possessions, and I can't wait to give it to my kids. Here's how it works. Each week, Storyworth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you help get to pick, like the ones I just talked about. Then Storyworth makes the writing process for your loved one a breeze. All they need to do is respond to that email question with a story. Long or short, doesn't matter. And then you'll be emailed a copy of your loved one's response as they're submitted over the course of the year. And you'll get to enjoy their retelling of the stories you already know or be surprised by stories you've never heard before. And after that year of fun, Storyworth compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book that you'll be able to share and revisit for generations to come. And you can keep a copy of the book for yourself. As I say, it's one of my most prized possessions because families love Storyworth. And that's why it has more than 25,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot, with millions of stories preserved since they were founded over 10 years ago. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift that you'll all treasure for years, Storyworth. And right now, you can save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/bookcase. That's storyworth.com/bookcase to save $10 on your first purchase. I'm so thankful my mom did this for my sister and I cannot wait to do it for my kids. So for Mother's Day this year, give the gift of your memories to someone you love. They will treasure it forever.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Rapid fire questions for Kao Kalia Yang. Dickens or Shakespeare?
Dickens.
Ooh, okay. Three writers you will read just because they wrote it.
Louise Erdrich, Roald Dahl, and Maxine Hong Kingston.
What's your favorite book to read to your children?
I love The Little Prince. They don't love it. I love it.
I have a book like that where I grab it. My daughter goes, "Not again." I'm like, "It may not be yours, but it's mine. So shut up." What is your finishing ritual? You've written a lot of children's books. You've written memoirs. Do you have a different finishing ritual for each, or is it the same for both? And do you have one?
I do. I eat lots of chips and salsa.
Love.
Do your children speak Hmong?
Very little. When I do, they fall asleep. It's very soft.
Ooh. It's a good soporific for them, huh? When did you realize I can write for a living?
I try to realize that every day, Charlie. writing is this thing. There's no guarantee that the next book will come out, the next story will be expressed. So every single day.
I like that answer. I tell myself that in the mirror every single day. Your favorite book on the craft of writing, if you have one?
Oh, right now, Body Work by Phoebos. It's on my shelf.
You're a teacher and a professor. So what books or book always make it onto your syllabus?
None. I teach new books every semester so that I'm as engaged as my students are.
Ah. When you read the manuscript to your mother, did you read it in English or Hmong?
I read it in Hmong.
Did you write it partially in Hmong?
Never. Always English.
So you had to translate as you read?
Yes. And that happens so often that it's almost second nature.
Huh. All right. My last one. As a fellow Minnesotan, I got to ask you, your favorite part about living in Minnesota, your least favorite part about living in Minnesota?
Least favorite part, Kate. I married a leaf kicker. I have bad allergies. Bad allergies. But one thing that we both enjoy is taking long walks together around the various lakes. And when the leaf kicking starts, my allergies start. Hate that. The favorite part, there are days in Minnesota that are more perfect than words. And nobody outside of Minnesota knows about these days. And I feel always that we're in this huge, shiny secret. You know exactly the days that I'm talking about, when the wind is perfect and the birds are chirping at just the right volume and the sky is, you know, blue with puffs of clouds, dreamy.
What a wonderful tribute to, I mean, you've written a wonderful tribute to your father and now you've written a wonderful tribute to your mother.
And I feel like I know her.
Thank you so much.
I feel like I know her. And I think that's what you're going for. And you did it.
Thank you both. You're giving me so much heart.
Thank you.
For this journey. Thank you.
Well, the book has a lot of it. The book has a lot of it.
Thank you both.
Kaukalia Yang, I really loved this book. And I was really touched during this interview because I was fascinated when I was reading the book. I'm like, okay, there's a love letter to there's quite a few children. And there's a love letter to this child calling out their individual personality. And there's a love letter to this child. And I thought to myself, well, where is the author? Where, you know, why doesn't she write a love letter to Kaukalia Yang? And when she said my mother's story was her love letter to me.
I mean, the whole book was her love letter to her daughter.
That she trusted me with her story, that she trusted me with her history, that she trusted me with her family's history. And the difficulties that she faced. And some of them are very personal. You know, some of those conversations could not have been easy about, you know, your father and I were talking about divorce for the fourth or fifth time in our marriage. And she did it. And I think that she does her mother so proud. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, I agree, Kate. And I still can't get over the fact that she was able to write it in the first person. That it was as if her mother was telling her story. Mm-hmm. And I can't get over that her mother said to her, why would you want to write this book? Nobody's going to be interested in reading it. We were interested in reading it. And we think everybody who's listening to this should be interested in reading it because it is a poignant and a very moving story and really a tribute to mothers in general. When Kaukalia Yang had to leave her mother in the forest of Laos, that was wrenching in the ultimate degree, and it's something she never got over. And then her husband had to leave his family in Laos, and then they spent all those years in the refugee camp in Thailand where they were right next to a flowing river of...
Filth.
Filth, right? And they had to wade that river of filth. It's amazing, and it bespeaks really the American story, I think. Her mother always felt that the United States was a racist country because she did not feel accepted. She didn't get promotions. She didn't whatever. That racism was always right below the surface. But she should be so proud of all of her kids who have done so well in the United States.
Yeah.
We have an amazing bookstore for you this week. Chapter One Books in Mendham Borough, New Jersey. owned by Sophia Maioli, who is 22 years old. She is an entrepreneur at a very young age. It takes a lot of guts.
Yeah, it takes a lot of pluck and courage and passion. I'm just amazed. I don't know. I mean, but gosh, if I at 22, if I knew where I'd left my purse and my phone and I managed to brush my hair before I got out of my apartment, it was a good day. So I have huge admiration for Sophia.
Our conversation with Sophia Maioli, Chapter One Books in Mendham Borough, New Jersey. Sophia Maioli of Chapter One Books in Mendham Borough, New Jersey. Good to have you with us. I'm curious, where was your site a year ago in April of 2023?
April 2023, I was in the very early stages. I've been working on the store for about past November, it was a year, and I was in the really early stages. I almost wasn't sure if I was even going to open. Once I purchased something, I was like, there's no going back. So I bought the floors and I was like, okay, there's no going back now. I have floors for this place.
Oh, I like that. That was the ripcord, was the floors. The ripcord was the floors. Yeah. Once you knew you had the floors, you're like, now I got to do this.
Yeah. And the laundromat had been there since, I want to say 1960. So there was a lot we had to redo. I'm fortunate enough that my sister actually does real estate development. So she has a contractor that she works with. And my father also does real estate development. So they both have a contractor and he worked with me. And my sister helped design the whole thing. She helped with the layout and kind of where to start as far as demoing the whole thing and building it up from the bottom. When I was looking at it, I tried to not look at it in its existing form. I looked at just like the blueprint, what could go where did I want a small storage room, where did I want a bathroom? And then I really wanted the whole space to be open so I didn't have to divide it up.
Mm. I'm always fascinated by how people land in the book business because it's an interesting ambition that needs to be driven by passion. So how did you sort of fall into it?
So I'm also an actor and I graduated high school 2020. So during COVID, I really got back into reading. And during auditioning and training, I kind of realized I needed something that I could also be doing at the same time when it wasn't so much, it's not so much of a steady career acting. So I needed something a little more steady at the same time. And when I fell back in love with reading, I was like, how fun would it be to open a bookstore? Just as like a crazy idea. I also love baking. So the original idea was a bookstore bakery, but it felt like a lot to take on for my first business to add food into it. So I was like, let's just start with the bookstore. And the reason I named it Chapter One was because then I can open a Chapter Two and add a bakery to it.
Nice. So we'll know you're done with the business when you open an epilogue.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, no, at that point, you're done. You're done. You've opened the epilogue. Okay, cool.
You just dropped in conversation there. I graduated from high school in 2020.
Yeah.
You're 22 years old and you've got a 1600 square foot bookstore.
Yes.
Sophia, that's pretty ambitious.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you really excited about for summer? What are you handing people for summer when they come in and say, I'm looking for a good read? What do you like?
I'm a huge romance reader. Mm. So I love a good romance summer love story. I'm also really excited because I'm working with the schools in Mendham to stock all of the summer reading books.
Cool.
So I have that coming up specifically for the middle and elementary school. I'm working on getting all the high school books in.
Cool.
So that's going to be really fun.
When you are a 22-year-old entrepreneur, you're younger than any bookstore owner we've talked to. Where did that entrepreneurial spirit come from?
My dad, he is an entrepreneur. And just seeing him do that growing up and working with my mom, I always was just like, it made it seem really possible to do it. It never felt like this impossible, scary thing to do. It was just a part of life. My dad was starting a new business. It was a thing. It's scary, but it never felt out of my reach. I did a lot of research and went to a lot of bookstores and looked at what they had and what I wanted and what I didn't want.
What did you decide you didn't want?
My biggest thing is that a lot of times when I go to a bookstore, I feel very overwhelmed. There's a lot of genres. There's just a lot happening. So I wanted everything to be really clean and I wanted it to be easy to look at different genres that you may not usually be interested in. Because for me, I go to a Barnes & Noble and I immediately go to the romance section. and don't look anywhere else because it's just a little overwhelming. I wanted it to be easy to just, oh, I'm looking at the biographies. Okay, here's also the history section. And then here's the mystery section. Like you could see everything right in front of your face.
That's really interesting.
I wish you great luck, Sophia.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Chapter one in Mendenboro on Main Street, East Main Street in Mendenboro, New Jersey. Good luck.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Wanted to kick so much butt. Yeah. Congratulations.
May there be many, many chapters to come. It was a year ago a laundromat, and now it's a 1,600 square foot bookstore. Good for her. That's just terrific.
Yeah. I mean, as if it's not intimidating enough opening a business, a bookstore at 22, you also have to deal with pulling apart the infrastructure of a laundromat. That's no joke, man.
Anyway, we want to make you aware of the good folks who make this podcast possible. And then we have a coda from Kyle Kalia Yang.
The Bookcase is a production of ABC Audio in partnership with Good Morning America. It is produced by David Canada in conjunction with SureCam Productions. Asal Essanapour is our producer. Laura Mayer and Simone Swink are our executive producers. We give special thanks to Taylor Rhodes, Amanda McMaster, and Sarah Russell of Good Morning America, and Josh Cohan, Nania McLean, Vika Aronson, and Brenda Salinas Baker at ABC Audio.
In the chasm between heaven and earth, all the mothers stand, holding the sky above their children. When the load is heavy, their knees bend, their arms shake. The earth trembles with their exertions. They do this so that the children remain protected. Even when the mothers are gone, the force of their love lingers in the light of dawn and dusk, beneath the sprinkles of sun and rain. May it always be so.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.